the What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hello there from Texas. How are you all? Welcome to the birthday edition of the What Bitcoin Did podcast, which is brought to you by the Mighty Kraken. Yes, it's 2 years. Well, on Sunday, it will be 2 years since I launched the very first episode of What Bitcoin Did, an interview that was recorded out in LA with Luke Martin. And because the universe is weird as shit, Luke and I found ourselves in the same city exactly 2 years to the day after recording that show. So Luke took me out for a few beers in Indianapolis, and with a stinking hangover, we did what we had to do. We recorded a follow-up show reflecting on the last 2 years. But before we get into that, I do have a message from my amazing sponsors. Make sure you check them out. Make sure you hit them up. It is the sponsors that allow me to travel around and do all these really cool interviews. So first up, we have the Mighty, Mighty Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade Bitcoin. I just caught up with the team this week to find out what's coming in 2020, and they have some cool shit coming. But have you downloaded the new Kraken Pro app? If it's no, why not? They've smashed it with this app, delivering all the security and features you love about the Kraken Exchange with a beautiful mobile-first design, which allows for advanced crypto trading on the go. So whether you're in Starbucks getting yourself a Frappuccino or you're sat on a plane, now you can buy more fucking Bitcoin on the go. And the app has got so much stuff packed in. It's got real-time price updates, multiple charting and order book display options. They've got advanced trading features. You can view a complete history of all your orders, trades, positions, deposits, and withdrawals. Fees as low as 0% with 24/7, 365 global support. Seriously, if you haven't got Kraken Pro, what are you doing with your life? It's available for the iPhone and Android. Just search for Kraken Pro, which is K-R-A-K-E-N-P-R-O. Next up is BlockFi. Yes, the amazing BlockFi. Yes, the future of Bitcoin and financial services. And if you listen to my upcoming show with Tudemeester, you're going to find out exactly why companies like BlockFi are so important to the future of Bitcoin, because they are building a suite of financial services with Bitcoin. They're helping mature the Bitcoin market. So if you need a crypto loan for your next holiday, if you want to get yourself one of those cyber trucks, a triangle on wheels, or because you've got to pay the man, BlockFi's got you covered. And also, if you want to earn interest on your Bitcoin, Ether, or GUSD, well, Bitcoin have got you covered with their interest accounts, and they've dropped all minimum deposits, they've removed the early withdrawal penalty, and you can choose to receive interest payments in the currency of your choice. I am a customer. I love getting my Bitcoin interest every month from BlockFi. So if you're interested in checking it out, do your own research and then head over to BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com. All right, so on to the show today with Luke Martin. And you know what? Luke was the very first guest I had on What Bitcoin Did. Just over 2 years ago, I was in LA. I kind of decided I was going to do a podcast. I spoke to my buddy Rich Roll. He told me what to do. So I hit Luke up. I hit him up on Twitter. I was like, man, do you want to make a podcast? And he was like, yeah, all right. So I went on Amazon, bought all the gear, which is pretty much mostly the same gear as I've got now. And since then, Luke stayed a friend. And I knew I wanted to get him back on the show at some point to catch up. And the universe delivered. So by pure coincidence, 2 years to the day after we recorded that, I found myself in Indianapolis and Luke was there. So he took me out, he filled me up with beer, and we recorded a follow-up show. And so much has changed in the 2 years since that interview for both of us and Bitcoin, right? And in this conversation, we get into that, what we've been up to, the highlights of the last couple of years, and our plans moving forward. Luke has always been a big supporter of the show and someone I stay in regular touch with. He's a great guy, gives me lots of advice on the side. Quite early on was telling me to stop getting fights on Twitter, but you know, also I've been kind of helping him when we've just stayed friends. So if you haven't checked out his podcast, it's the Coining Podcast. Definitely go and check it out. It's primarily focused on trading, exchanges, and crypto markets. Yes, he covers some shit coins, not a lot, but it's well worth a listen. Anyway, if you've got any questions about the show, hit me up. It's hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Just a couple of updates. Firstly, if you haven't checked out my show with Andreas on Defiance, go and check it out, Why We Need Bitcoin. Andreas delivers as normal. It's a fucking great show. Go and check that out. Also, I'm in Texas right now, recording a whole bunch of shows with the Bitcoin gang here. Yesterday, I recorded with Bitstein, Tudemeester, and today I'm going to be recording with Jimmy Song. I also recorded a show with Texas Gun Sense and a lady who sadly lost her son to a gun accident. But that's a follow-up to my show with Ragnarly. I did want to hear some different opinions on gun rights. Please do check that out when that comes out. Tomorrow, I'm going to be heading off to LA. And next week, I might change my plans. I might head out to the Trump rally in Florida. I think I want to see this craziness in person. I also might then head to DC and then it'll be New York for Thanksgiving and back home. If you're in any of those places, you want to hang out, let me know. All right, any questions about the show, please hit me up. Luke, man, 2 years
to the wild.
To the day, exactly. Feels a lot longer.
It does feel longer. I think crypto has a way of distorting time, making everything seem longer, and also at the same time, things seem to move at a pretty rapid pace here.
I've had it before where people have been like, oh, how long have I known you? And they're like, I think it's like 4 months. I was like, shit, I thought I'd known you for like a year and a half.
Yeah.
But 2 years. Thanks, man. I think some of this equipment's the same. There's still the same mic stands.
Still the same mic stands, the same mics.
Well, no, they're replacements.
Okay.
They've broke. This is the same. These are new. The wires are new. Half of the equipment's the same as what we did 2 years ago.
Yeah.
It was so funny, man, like looking back, like reflecting on doing this interview and thinking, yeah, like what it's become and watching what you've done and trying to like take it all in.
Sure.
Because I didn't start the podcast to make any money or a career. I was just hanging out in LA and was trading, but I knew I wasn't good at it. I knew it was luck. And I said to my friend Rich Roll, and I was like, I'm going to do a podcast. How do you do it? And he said, go and check out the Pat Flynn course, which I did. And then I decided I was going to do it. And I knew you were in LA. And I was like, so I messaged you and I'm like, Luke, do you want to do the show? You said yes. And then I bought the equipment on Amazon, and I think it was like the next day we did it.
Next day, yeah. Showed up in the valley.
Yeah, in the Uber.
Yep.
And we recorded the first show. I said to you yesterday when we were out drinking that I've tried to listen to that show back. It's really painful.
It's rough.
It's rough. I'll tell you what else is funny about it. You know the intros and outros?
Sure.
I used to record them without a mistake, so actually it was like 50 takes to do it. And after I was about 10 episodes in, my engineer said to me, because I was talking about saying, oh, I just hate doing the intro and outro. It takes like 50 takes. He said, what, if you make a mistake, you start again? I was like, yeah. He said, no, you can just, I can edit those out.
Yeah, chop it up.
Yeah, I can chop it up. I was like, really? It saved me like an hour or two for each show, man. But how do you look back on the last 2 years?
Oh, man, that's... I don't know. It's such a big question. It's almost impossible to think. It's nearly the same way. I think you get into this. Yeah, you get into this and you don't really have... Obviously, I came in and wanted to learn, wanted to meet as many people as I could, but you don't... Everything kind of happens in some way, even if you do have your goals set out or have some things you want to accomplish or people you want to meet. Things move at such a rapid pace, and try to say yes to as many opportunities as I can, like you sliding by in LA and... you know, fortunate enough to have some of those turn into some really good deals.
Do you have a like standout moment, anything from the last 2 years where you're like, where you're able to look at that and go, wow? Because I've got one. I'll tell you mine in a minute.
I mean, really, I actually think I mentioned this to you yesterday when we were getting drinks was, and it wasn't anything crazy that happened that day, but it was, I was leaving grad school at the time or trying to decide if I should leave grad school. Just got into the master's program that I really wanted to. And I had already missed a quiz that week. I was just really obsessed with jumping down the rabbit hole. And I really wanted to attend a conference that week. And it wasn't like conferences we have now, Consensus, which is $1,000 overbooked. It was a small thing I saw people talking about on Twitter. I think Ari Paul posted it on Twitter. And I called my parents and I was saying, you know, I really think I have to bail on, you know, my first big accounting test in master's. I think I need to go to the conference. And I had never wanted to go to a conference before. My first job in SF, it was an interesting job, but it was fucking awful. Like, I didn't want to go to a conference for fun. And I went to this conference and, you know, was able to speak with him and saw Joey Krug and a lot of other guys talk. And it was just this idea that, you know, having your mind constantly working on, you know, thinking about what you want to be working on is kind of an amazing thing. And that was kind of the first time I'd ever had it, so... I think that moment was big, and
that's quite early on, though.
That was early on. I think recently as well, getting to speak on that CNN segment, which came up, is a pretty hilarious way that actually came up. I think Pomp tweeted about going on CNN, and he said, "What should we talk about?" Drops the fire emojis like he always does, and I posted below, kind of half kidding, because it's CNN. I said, you know, stomp out some of the fake news happening in Bitcoin, which is also, I think, a problem on CNBC. They consistently talk about, you know, Bitcoin can be hacked, all these different things. And the producer messages back and says, the CNN producer, and I'm trying to tell if it's a real Twitter account. And she says, hey, Luke, you know, can you speak with who runs the show, Julia Chatterley. And I said, well, sure, yeah, I still can't really tell if she's a real person. Sets up a phone call, and it turns out to be the real person. She said, yeah, I saw your comment under Palm's tweet, so let's do a whole segment about getting rid of the fake news. Wow. And so in my head, I'm like, does she know I was trolling CNN saying I don't like fake news? Uh-huh. But it worked out, and it was a pretty cool show, too.
Did you go to the studio to do it?
Yeah, in New York.
Wow, yeah. That must have been very cool.
It was epic. It was epic, yeah.
So I'll tell you mine, because it is a real standout moment. And I've talked about this a few times, and you've got to remember the build-up, like the years before I've had, you know, divorce, drug addiction, mum dying. So there's a lot of shit stuff happened. Now, my company collapsed. Yeah, everything just went to shit. But then obviously I did the podcast, and there's no real moment in doing the podcast where you go from, I'm a guy's recorded the first episode, to like, oh shit, this is something serious. Like, it's just, there's a transition. But when I launched the second show, I had the opportunity to go out to Taiwan and interview Tae Yong Ho, who is the most senior defector from North Korea.
Sure.
He was based in London and he defected. And I was like, yeah, cool, I'm going to do that. So I went out and I met him in reception, and he turns up with four bodyguards because Kim Jong Il wants to kill him.
Yeah,
he wants to kill him. Oh, you know, and gosh, he will kill people, right? You know, he killed his brother at Malaysia Airport. So we get in the lift, me, him, and these four big guys, right? And I am thinking, wow, this is mad. So we get to the room, and I have to wait outside where they go and go through my room and check my room.
Of course.
And then they stand outside my room guarding it, and we sit down like you and I now. And I just had this moment where I was just like, whoa, this is a bit fucking mental.
That's
Yeah, and luckily out of all of this, you know, I've got this new career, which I really enjoy. I've got two shows now, and I love it.
Did you have that thought? I mean, before our interview, I know you didn't plan to make any money or know how big it could be, but did you have a thought of, this is something I'm going to pursue for years, or was it a project, I want to try it out?
No, it was just try it out. Yeah. I'll try anything out, see how it goes. Yeah. You know, I did the first show, and then I did the show with Nick, and then I wrote to Lop, because I saw this picture of this cool guy with his guns and a beard, and I was just like, he's cool. So I wrote to him, and I said, like, oh, I've got this little podcast, can I come and interview you? And he said, yeah, and I said, well, look, I'll fly out. And by the way, I've never shot a gun. Can we go shoot guns? And he was like, yeah. So I went out and did that. There are key moments that do stand out. So I think we talked about this last night, interviewing Lynn Albrecht. Mm. And that turned out to be on Ross's birthday, and the Silk Road is how I first discovered Bitcoin. So that was quite important to me. And I knew I had to take it serious, because we're dealing with someone's lives here. This isn't just about magic internet money. This is someone who is in prison for the rest of their life for something which I don't believe they should be. So that one I really prepared for, because I wanted to be compassionate in the interview, and, you know, I actually videoed that one, and, you know, I'm really proud of that as an interview. It seemed as like my 10th. I think when I started to realize it could really be something, it was over a year in. I think it was last August last year when I got my first check, which was like 2000. But when I got my first proper deal, which was with BlockFi, a proper negotiated multi-month deal, I was like, okay, this can become really serious. And then there's so many different wins along the way, you know, whether it's getting the Szabo interview, which actually is his first proper solo interview.
Yeah,
because the one he did with Tim Ferriss was alongside Naval. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a huge win. Or getting Peter Willow on was a huge win. And, you know, and all the different opportunities that come to you. But there's never like one moment. There's just like this slow kind of growth, and lots of things happen.
Lots of things, yeah, you can look back on and appreciate.
Yeah, and it's been mad. I mean, I've traveled the world. I've been to Japan twice, Taiwan, the States countless times. Probably 100 flights in 2 years.
Yeah. You travel in more of the country than I am. I live here, man.
Yeah, I've been ticking off a lot of the States now. I think I've done 12 of the States now, maybe more. Yeah. And it's traveling around America is really interesting, Luke, because it's so different.
Than traveling Europe and everywhere else.
I mean, the States themselves are so different. Okay. They're like different countries.
Yeah, yeah,
they just speak English.
Yeah.
You know, Wyoming is so different from New York, which is so different from Texas. I think Texas is definitely one of my favorites. So, yeah, man. And so you're now a podcaster as well?
Yeah, it's something that I definitely want to pursue more. I mean, that's going into 2020, it's definitely a goal of mine to focus a lot more time on it. Probably won't have two shows like yourself, but no, looking to nearly be doing it full time. Yeah, and it's one of those things too that I also, when I started, it wasn't really like I can make a business out of this or this is going to make me money. The same with the Twitter account. It was just like, well, this is actually a great way to speak to people that I probably wouldn't have access to anyways. And it's almost like an excuse sometimes for me to be a little bit selfish and honestly ask the questions that I want. I've gone through this thing where at the beginning it was, how can I set up a show that people will be interested in? As opposed to now, I don't want to do that because almost everyone has that same line of thinking. And then you get this repetitive, you know, same circle of guests, whatever it is. So you always have to find find that new angle. Yeah, man, but I love it.
Yeah, it's like, where can you innovate?
Exactly.
There's like, I mean, crypto broadly, there might be like 50 podcasts. I see so many mentioned, maybe 25, I don't know. And then there's Bitcoin ones. And you can find, like I was driving the other day and I was going through them looking for shows to listen to. And it's a lot of the same guests over and over again, all fantastic people. So there's no discredit to them, but sure. It's Trace Mayer, it's Safe Dina Moose, it's, you know, Dan Held, it's, you know, a lot of the same people. And in what I'm trying to do now is I'm like, well, how do we grow the pie? Like, what are the new people we can talk to?
Sure.
Which is why I did Hotep Jesus, which I know was controversial. Jamie Bartlett, who just did The Missing Crypto Queen. You know, uh-huh. I've just interviewed Stoya, the adult actress. It's like, where are the new people we can talk to where Bitcoin might touch their life or might have a different perspective? I guess that's what I'm looking at.
And also what's tough, and I think that a lot of times maybe people ignore this or just don't think about it, but there's so many brilliant people that aren't spending all day on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this very loud, smallish group of people. It's a big industry, but still relatively small, that have these large followings on Twitter and they're the most outspoken. I'm sure there's hundreds or thousands, maybe, people that are fascinated by this, just don't spend so much time on Twitter.
Yeah.
And being able to get their perspective, I think, is a whole new angle. There's so many ways to take it, man. The investment side, which is what I like to focus on, versus kind of the entire Bitcoin, all the granular stuff that you and the other Bitcoiners like to focus on as well.
Well, we'll get into Bitcoin. There's a lot to talk about Bitcoin. But what have you found out about yourself, like, in making the show?
I found out, honestly, that I really do appreciate just the creating a show, the editing. I know that I shouldn't be doing all the editing, and eventually I need to outsource that, but I really do enjoy that.
I think by doing it, you learn a lot more about the construction of a show, though.
Like, oh, yes.
Like, I did, for a good year and a half, I edited my show because, you know, the Bitcoin price dropped, so I couldn't afford an editor, so I did it all myself.
Yeah.
I would edit in Audacity and then arrange in GarageBand. But I learned a lot about, like, the shape of a show because, actually, I'll tell you what else I learned. I learned a lot about approach to interviewing as well because I had to re-listen to every show. That doesn't happen now. When the show's recorded, this, I won't re-listen to this because the engineer does. I mean, I might go back, but because somebody else is doing it, I don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
Which I feel like I'm losing something with that as well.
Yeah. Well, partially, I don't know. I very rarely re-listen to myself unless I'm editing, right? But I'm just kind of skimming through. I've also learned that usually the best conversation almost always happens right after you stop the interview.
Yeah.
Every single time, it's like that question I've been dying to ask, but I'm not sure it's appropriate, and then that starts a whole other thing.
Why didn't I leave the mic on?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's a lesson I'm slowly learning. But also just so many things about conversation styles, how to warm someone up and get them to where you want without directly asking the question. So many things, man,
person?
It's tough.
Have you done any interviews in person?
No. Well, no, I haven't had the chance to.
Yeah, I think you should try that.
Well, that's the next step in 2020 is I want to do a very similar thing.
Yeah.
Is fly out and do it. It also makes the video better. I mean, it just makes the entire, it makes the mood better. Sometimes it's hard to get that
mm-hmm.
on Skype or on...
get the rapport going.
Yeah.
Or the hangover.
Yeah.
I was talking to you last night, I remember as well, about... Well, I'll tell you what I was talking about first is I don't think a lot of people understand how much work goes involved. Like, I've had a lot of people to me and say, oh, I want to do a podcast. So you have to sit down and explain it all. There's a lot.
Yeah, I think a lot of people say they want to start a podcast. It's like starting any other business. I mean, everyone has a great idea, and I think that people should. But what happens a lot of it's the same with a YouTube or a Twitter account. Unless you're going to be insanely consistent and seriously pushing and putting in more hours than the podcast should take, you're just going to fall behind. I mean, you said this from day one. You said, Luke, it's a full-time thing. You have to do it weekly, or you have to set a schedule. You have to do this. And at first, I was like, oh, I'll just do an interview whenever. Right? I got Arthur Hayes. I'll do the interview. Then I can't find another one for a month, and I put it off another month. Unless you have that weekly schedule, oh, man, it's impossible.
Yeah, you've got to be consistent. Because, you know, I was listening to a show on the way in, actually, the Tom Woods show,
and he was talking to another guy who has a show, and they were saying, like, most shows actually don't get past 7 episodes because people give up.
Yeah.
But if you miss a week and someone's expecting it, then there's plenty of other shows they can go to.
Sure.
And you can lose some loyalty from that as well.
It's also, there's a weird thing that happens. You can have two completely unrelated guests, but just by having a consistent show, it almost makes, just tying in each show together, every single extra show that you do, that next marginal show,
yeah,
is better because you tie in all the other guests, you're in a better flow. It's all these different things, they add up together. But if you're not doing it consistently, it shows.
Well, that's that consistent narrative I talked about that Rogan does very well. What I realized is they're not independent interviews. It is a constant body of work, which is like a lens on society and what's happening in society.
Yeah.
So, you know, like I said, one week he might have an MMA guy, and the next week he might have Be Real from Cypress Hill, and then next week he might have, I don't know, like Andrew Yang on. A lot of the topics that he will talk about will consistently ring through, whether it's Antifa, whether it's freedom of speech. And I think that's what people get hooked into, because, and one of the really good things about it is this ongoing narrative is that if you keep talking to other people, I think you frame a better conversation and you frame a better understanding of things. You know, when you go to something like Twitter, which I'm terrible at because all I do is fight everyone and argue and get into fucking bullshit. But that never
happened. You fight less now.
Fight less. Yeah, well, that's because you told me off. Like, what was that? Like, that was like a, I think that wasn't long after the Roger Ver interview. You got in touch with me and you're like, I remember it. You came to me on Twitter and you're like, Pete, I think you need to stop fighting everyone. Yeah. And it was funny. Somebody else did it. This guy, Jamie Burke, did it as well. He's like, even if you think you've won the argument, you don't actually win anything.
Yeah.
But the problem with Twitter is it becomes a fight. But I've never gotten in a fight in an interview. I mean, a mild one with Brock Pierce, but never really gotten into a fight.
See, that when I listened to that, it didn't really come off as a fight. I think it was combative, or maybe there's just a misunderstanding of your intent. But it didn't, I thought it was enjoyable to listen to. Yeah. And I think, you know, I don't know. You did a part two, yeah?
Yeah, well, he interviewed me. So, I mean, I'll be honest. Like, I went into it, and I think the guy's a dick. I'll be honest. And he might listen to this, but whatever. I just think
I don't think he's going to listen to this.
Well, he might if someone tells him. Someone tweets out, Pete called you a dick. But I think he's a dick. I do. And I'm not, I don't care about calling someone a, I think if someone's a dick, you need to call them out. Now, I get called a dick all the time because I can be. But I think he's a dick, and I think what he was doing with Mt. Gox was a dickish move, because he was getting, he was kind of upsetting something that was in progress. So I just thought, I'm gonna prod you on certain things which I disagree with. And it was when he said, oh, do you trust Mark Harpalis? And I just said, I don't trust either of you. And I think that's what really got him going. But yeah,
I think Mark's interview just came out more sincere. And I listened to a lot of those shows. I don't know the full story. I'm sure Brock or Mark themselves obviously know more about the situation than me or some of the creditors, but it seemed like, just on my basic understanding, there had to be an angle for him to want to get involved, and I didn't understand what that incentive was, but there has to be one. I don't think it's entirely altruistic.
Yep.
And Mark seemed, I don't know, maybe he was not capable and shouldn't have been running it, and it was negligent and all these things, but listening to him, unless he's just a very good actor, it seemed like his intent was more pure in trying to get this thing solved and trying to kind of write his name.
Yeah, well, that's why I really want to do the interviews in person, because I, sitting down with Mark, spending time with him before the interview and talking to him, I kind of got a feel for him. And also, I read a lot into the case. And, you know, I think the thing what happened was, I always said that I think people would look at Mt. Gox with a 20K Bitcoin lens.
Yeah.
Whereas it wasn't a 20K Bitcoin at the time when it happened. And what happened, you know, he took over the site from Jed, you know, that was arguably trading insolvent already. I think they were down like 80,000 Bitcoin. I can't remember. But, and I think he was just out of his depth and this thing just spun up and he didn't have the competence or the capacity to deal with it. And he just kept digging a deeper and deeper hole. Now, he was in the wrong, but I don't think he was malicious. I just think he was incompetent. And when you look at someone like Brock, you know, I don't think it was altruistic. There was a financial incentive because he wanted to start a new exchange and he wanted to get all those OGs trading on it. And I did not trust the guy at all.
I was actually interested in that, though. I kind of wanted him to start that exchange. The exchange industry in crypto has got to be one of the most fascinating tales right now, because even at its current market cap, the $200 billion or whatever it is, the reason that so many derivatives exchanges are popping up is because the volume on these derivative exchanges, are, whoever can capture that is going to be, you know, 100x volume eventually. So whether it's BitMEX or someone else, I think a lot of them can do really well. That would have been so cool to see what this new Mt. Gox could be. I'm not sure if people would ever trust it, but if you can run an exchange, get it up and get some volume, that's essentially a money printer. I know it's a bit of a honeypot. You know, there's always security risks, but...
Hence not altruism, though. It's a money pot.
But it's the best business you can have right now in crypto. Those are the most valuable speculation industry right now.
Yeah, I just wouldn't want to put any money in Brock Pierce's pocket.
Into Mt. Gox, too?
Well, I mean, the name's tarnished. Like, let it die. Like, yeah. It's tarnished. Let it go. Let people move on, you know. But the funny thing was when he wanted to do a follow-up interview, because he didn't come across well, and a lot of people said, apart from, like, two people who, obviously, Brock Pierce fans, but... he didn't come across very well, and there were a lot of tweets saying he didn't. So he approached me and said, look, and he apologized, like, in fairness to him.
He was aware enough to realize that.
And, yeah. So yeah. He was like, I'd like to do a follow-up interview with you. And I was like, okay, fair enough. I was in Chicago at the time, so it was recorded remotely, and I was in the hotel room. And he did this really weird thing happened whereby I loaded up the Skype, and he was there. And he sat there for 10 minutes without acknowledging me on his phone. And I was like, is this some... I'm sat there, like, smiling, going, hi, like, waving. And I was like, it's a power move.
It's like the Donald Trump yank when he shakes your hand right there.
I was like, is this a power move? And then it turned out to just be such a nothing interview. Like, he just wanted to know some stuff about me, and it was nothing in the end. But I did also bump into him again in Oslo at the Freedom Forum. And I didn't go to his session because, I didn't want to. I don't like him. I'm sorry.
That interview aside, that series was... the series ideas that you've done... I mean, that's an incredible... What, you have a new series coming out? Anything you're working on that you can make public?
Yeah, there's a few things. I think I've already mentioned it. Let me tell you about the background to that, though, because, again, that was funny because it wasn't planned as a series. And I've got to say a big thanks to Ryan... oh, what's his name? Let me get his name because he deserves a shout-out for this because he's the reason it happened, right? Mm-hmm. Ryan Calder. Really nice guy out in LA. If you ever go there, just meet the guy. He's just the nicest person you'll ever meet. But what happened is that I got introduced to Jed. I won't say who introduced me. Someone said, look, you should do an interview with Jed. So I got the interview with Jed and went out to San Fran and did it. And we got into some of the Mt. Gox stuff, and, you know, it was quite revealing. I mean, some of the stuff I was surprised he talked about, I think he probably even regrets. So I did that, and I'd been trying to get Mark Karpalis to come on for a year, and he was just like, no. He did an AMA, and I asked him. He then DM'd me and then just didn't reply again. But I would send Mark an email every 3 months saying, if you change your mind, I'll come out to Japan. You know, same rules as everyone else. You know, if there's something you don't want to ask, you don't have to, but I'd like to interview you. He just went silent. I did the interview with Jed, and I mailed him, and I said, oh, I've done an interview with Jed. Would you be interested to do one? And he's like, yep, straight away.
Oh, wow.
So I had that one booked, and I was out in LA, and I was Ryan wanted to meet up for a beer. So I met up with him, I think it was a meet on Ocean, and we were having a drink at the bar, and I told him about this. And he was like, oh, well... there's all these other people that are really interesting. You know, you should speak to Brock and you should speak to... like, he listed off all the people, Daniel Kelman and Kim Nelson, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, okay. He was like, can you connect me? And he did. And I was like, you know what? I could just make this into a series. So I did, and I ended up doing it. I think a lot of people appreciated it because it was like a first time that the Mt. Gox had been kind of distilled into a body of work. If I was to do it again, I would structure it more like Serial, whereby I would... have chapters rather than people, and I would knit together a narrative.
Chronologically as well. Yeah.
So I've got an interest. So the reason I've told you that is because you said, am I going to do anything else? I have been working in the background for quite a long time on what happened with S2X, what happened with the New York agreement, you know, the fork. I've kind of got this idea, well, I've got a name. It's like the Battle for Bitcoin, which I think is a strong name.
Yeah.
So yes, I want to do that. But I also want to document the Silk Road. And I've talked to Lynn about that, and I've said I think it would be very interesting to document exactly what happened again in a serial kind of format.
Yeah.
And then I'd like to do one about Craig Wright, because even though he's suing me, and lawyer said don't talk about him anymore. Even though he's suing me, I still find him actually fascinating. Like, as a character and a human, like, how fascinating is it that this person behaves in the way they do?
Yeah, it's a TV show. I mean, it's bizarre.
Yeah. So, yeah, I've got an interest in doing those seasons. I think they work. I think people get interested in it. I've also got a beginner's guide, which I've also started work on. But look, it's time, man. Like, all this shit together.
Endless
amounts of work. And then beyond that, you know, I have also I wanted to do Defiance News, and I was listening to the Rogan interview with Matthew Taibbi yesterday, and I actually think there's legs in doing a media company which is entirely based on podcasting, because people still listen to podcasts because it's dead time, you know, running at the gym, etc. Yeah. Whereas, you know, print news is kind of dying. You know, you can do a 6-month investigative journalism piece that, you know, dies in 36 hours. That's what Matthew Taibbi was talking about. It's like investigation into Trump's numbers. Whereas the podcasting is like multitasking, right? So you can listen to it. So I think there's legs in a lot of things. It's finding the time. I'm sure you've got loads of ideas what you want to do.
Oh, a million. I have a series I'm working on.
Yeah?
Yeah, that'll be out. I don't want to spoil that, though.
Oh, well, okay. But if I can help you in any way, you should let me know. But I think people buy into that. I think they buy into it as a block of work. And
the other thing is there's an abundance of information. You can get information anywhere, and you can reach most people on Twitter, but it's not always digestible. And and I think, you know, like LOP has that incredible resource guide. If you had, you could almost make a series on every single section of that as a way easier, you know, if someone getting in, they're trying to understand that Segwit 2X and all these different things, someone just reading this for the first time while they're also trying to wrap their head around Bitcoin versus crypto, you know, all these things, it's impossible. They'll hit a dead end. They won't want to learn more, or they'll just kind of give up on even trying to understand it. So if it's an easier, smoother way and an on-ramp, I think that's huge.
Yeah. So where are you at with trading now? How much of a trader are you still?
I would say it's a lot less often, partially because now I'm running the show and I do so much work as an analyst and all those different things. But also, you have to kind of adjust to the market. I mean, for the past year and a half, we haven't had a single altcoin theme that lasts longer than 7 to 10 days in, what, 12 months? I mean, a lot of that market it's ignored, but a lot of those things are still down 80-90%. And so, you know, Bitcoin still presents some opportunities, but a lot of what I do, I wouldn't even say it's trading. It's more like allocating, right? I think of it as almost like a slow swinging pendulum. Like, is Bitcoin trending up? Is the value good? And is momentum good? Mm-hmm. I want to be more exposed versus taking some off. And I think this trading versus holding meme gets such hate from some of the Bitcoin community, and it's a great meme to have, right? The holders of last resort, Trace Mayer has a really good segment on that. But if trading is looked at maybe in a different light, I mean, consider active managers for if they're managing your retirement money or they're managing your investments. What active managers aren't trying to do is, you know, hedge funds get all this shit if they don't beat the S&P. Well, of course, a hedge fund isn't going to beat the S&P when it's a bull market, because there should be hedged. They should be taking less risk, right? So you have to think of an appropriate benchmark. And I think that for a lot of people trading Bitcoin, it shouldn't be this idea of Bitcoin's a great benchmark if you're investing in altcoins. But if you're trading or actively managing some of your Bitcoin, maybe just having a lower risk profile or a lower risk tolerance for those holdings is what's going to keep you in the game. This idea of holding, you know, if you would have held your Bitcoin, you would have made 500%. Did you trade and you only made 300%? Well, maybe that person holding through 2018, people do sell near the bottom, right? People are emotional. I know a ton of people that sold Bitcoin when it's falling 6K and then they never get back in. So if you have some kind of rule, I mean, a very arbitrary thing of having 60% in Bitcoin, 40% in cash, rebalancing quarterly if that ever gets out of whack. So if Bitcoin rises, your Bitcoin's probably going to be 80, your cash should be 20. Moving some of that Bitcoin to cash. And it's just really to even out the swings more than it is. Sure, holding would have beat that strategy. But if you didn't stay in the game because you couldn't weather the hold, then you're completely out of it anyways. Right. And so it's just this idea. People do it with stocks as well. I mean, that's when everyone calls their financial advisor, is when stocks are in a bear market near the bottom. So you have to have some kind of rule set that keeps you in. I think hold is a great meme if you can do it, but a lot of people can't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's more of the way that I think about Bitcoin for my own strategy. And then, like I said, alts have been far and few between with those opportunities.
Next up, I talked to Luke more about the last 2 years, but before that, I've got a message from my amazing sponsors. So first up, Wire. And thank you so far to everyone who has checked them out, those who've got in touch, those who've created an account. I caught up with Dunny this week, and he told me the ads have really delivered. But that does mean if you haven't checked them out, you still should. Come on, help out Wire. They are absolutely smashing it. why are helping companies across the space offer Bitcoin onboarding. So it doesn't matter if you're a solo developer or you've got a big ass team, if you are looking to simplify user onboarding, if you want to give your users a fast and easy way to purchase Bitcoin, then you got to talk to Wire. Since 2013, they have been smashing it. They've taken care of all of the heavy lifting, all the stuff with compliance, payments and liquidity, so you can focus on building your core offering. If you've got the idea for the next killer app, don't let those regulators kill it. Find out more, reach out to Wire or create a developer account over at sendwire.com, which is sendwire.com. Also, we have the amazing Dropbit, the best mobile wallet in the business, and Dropbit are absolutely killing it. I was out in Ohio last week. I was catching up with the team, finding out what ideas they've got, and I'm going to definitely convince them to get me a Lambo at some point. Actually, I might get them to get me a Cybertruck. A fucking Cybertruck. Keep downloading the wallet if you want me to get some badass car. But have you checked them out yet? If you've not, why not? Come on. They've got so much going on in this wallet. They recently announced the arrival of Lightning. Not only that, they now support Betch32 addresses, and they've now got onboarding. You can now buy Bitcoin directly in the app. On top of that, you can tweet Bitcoin, you can text Bitcoin, you can do so much with this app. Seriously, if you haven't downloaded it, stop being a loser. It's available for the iPhone and Android. Just head over to dropbit.app, which is dropbit.app. Also, if you want me to unlock your Lightning wallet in Dropbit, just hit me up on Twitter. I've got you. I'll send you a few sats. Lastly today, I want to give a massive shout out to my main man, Leon, and his conference, Advancing Bitcoin, which I'm going to be an MC for. Leon isn't paying me for this ad, so you really need to check it out. He's doing some great stuff. I want to do everything I can to help him make sure this is a sellout. I'm going to be MC for the event, and it's in London on February the 6th and 7th. So if you're coming down to London, if you want to grab a cup of tea, go and get some fish and chips, let me know. I gotcha. There will be some amazing speakers there. Andrew Polstra, who's twice been on my show. Andrew Chow, Jimmy Song, Nicholas Dorier, and loads of the most amazing companies in Bitcoin. There's going to be Blockstream, Chaincode Labs, Square Crypto, Wasabi Wallet, and many, many more. I'm really excited to be part of this. If you want a 10% discount on your tickets, head over to advancingbitcoin.com and use the code Peter.
I haven't actually done an active trade in over a year. I've sold stuff because I'm getting out of altcoins. So when I sold all my altcoins earlier this year and the show went Bitcoin early, and I've acquired Bitcoin. Actually, I haven't even bought Bitcoin. I've earned Bitcoin. The Andreas, sure. Andreas says, earn Bitcoin. So, you know, a couple of my clients pay in Bitcoin. I convert 75% to cash and hold the other 25% in Bitcoin. So my Bitcoin balance is just steadily going up. I earn interest through BlockFi. Mm. So, and I just keep a record every month. So rather than ever worrying, I always know there's never going to come a month where I'm going to have less Bitcoin because of that. But I stopped trading, one, because I'm terrible at it, but also because I don't have the time, and I lost entire belief in alts as a... I couldn't see any value in anything anymore. I went, you know, and there's a lot of things that went into that, you know, the whole, you've got a Bitcoin show, stop covering shit coins, you know,
yeah.
When I did the Ryzen interview, but I was naturally, like, the gravity was pulling me in of Bitcoin. And it's been a really good thing. You know, I take the piss out of altcoiners and, you know, upset them occasionally. But I fundamentally believe is that if you ask me what's going to be here in 10 years, I believe Bitcoin will be. I could not tell you a single alt that alt. I mean, Ethereum in somewhere or another might still exist, but I think most of it is a problem because people aren't using it.
Well, yeah, they're all still fighting for a use case when Bitcoin has established that. Mm. Bitcoin already has the investment thesis, the store of value. And altcoins, I think, you know, each of them can have their limited supply or their supply schedule or whatever it might be. But as a whole, it's almost no cost to produce more or another one. You can always spin up another ICO. And so as they fight for that use case with an ever-increasing supply, yeah, it's very rational to a higher probability that Bitcoin will be around the longest and maybe the only one that survives.
Do you like anything else? Do you look at anything else and go, actually, I do like that?
I think that anything that resembles, well, that carries a risk of its own, but anything that almost resembles equity, and I know that a lot of pretty much every exchange owner that has a coin will say it's not equity, But some of those coins are interesting to me, even if they're a quasi-equity and they're doing everything not to be security. But if they offer a yield or there's some kind of buy and burn, I still am quite interested in a lot of those models. But at the same time, I really treat them as, I don't think, let's say I do establish a position in some exchange coin. It's not like Bitcoin where I have an investment thesis of 2, 5, 10 or however many years. It's looking for a cyclical upturn, or you have some kind of target and looking to scale out. I really do treat it as a shorter term investment.
Yeah.
And so I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I know some listeners of this show are, oh, that's evil and all this stuff. But, is shorting Bitcoin, is that evil? Turn more Bitcoin?
Yeah.
Is trading my Bitcoin and selling it to you higher, is that evil? Like, what's the line? As long as you're not promoting it, right? Pumping it or scamming people in some way, investing in that, if you believe in it or you find it interesting or it makes you money, I like those opportunities.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see what your position will be if you went full-time podcasting.
Yeah.
If that became all you did, and I fully see you as a more than a crypto, I talked to you about this last night, more than a crypto podcaster. I think you understand markets and trading and you understand how it all works, but I'll be interested in where you'll be, say, a year afterwards. I could see you drifting more to Bitcoin. I could see it over time.
I would say I'm already kind of there.
Right, okay.
Definitely. I mean, that's what I think about. If I'm thinking about any, and the only thing that really makes my head turn is still Bitcoin.
Yeah.
About the space. I'm always open to learning about some, but I have such almost a dismissive attitude, I guess, and maybe that's not the right word, towards a lot of the stuff coming out. Like, I don't think I've read a white paper in, I don't know when, since the last ICO I invested in, which was like 2017, early 2018. Yeah, Bitcoin is where all of my focus is. But in terms of understanding trends and things like that, I'll still look at those coins. I think it's still a very inefficient market. And I think those opportunities are going to exist for a while.
One of the key things for me with Bitcoin is I actually use it. And that's the key difference to everything else. Like, I pay people in Bitcoin. Like, say if we went out to dinner and I forgot to give you the money, I don't have Venmo, but I'd be like, oh, Luke, just give me a Bitcoin address. Sure. I actually use it. And it's a really easy way for transferring money internationally. Like, getting paid in Bitcoin's really easy.
Getting paid is preferred.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like the way, Bitcoin doesn't change too much. I know people will say, oh, well, it was originally peer-to-peer cash and now it's a store of value. If that's the only change it's ever had, then that's quite neat. Whereas you look at something like Ethereum, computer, then it was for ICOs, now it's for stable coins. Like, it's trying to find a solution. And I also look at what's building out around Bitcoin. Like, there's some fucking good companies, beyond the exchanges. I'm a big fan of BlockFi. Yes, they're for transparency, they're a sponsor. You will have heard it anyway. But actually, they're doing a really neat thing where they're integrating financial services. They've got a lending and they've got an interest market, and it's that's very interesting. I really like what Fold are doing and Lolli are doing, where you can earn interest or cash back on using their apps. I really like what Cast is doing in creating almost like that be your own bank from home. There's some really neat businesses building around it. And then I look at something like EOS or Ethereum, and I was mildly interested in MakerDAO at some point, and then I realized it's so complicated, I don't understand it. I think the whole narrative breaks down into stupidity when you break it apart. But there is something there in Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, for me, to be completely honest, I don't even find a lot of the peer-to-peer cash or using it when I pay for something on Amazon or whatever that interesting. I think just as an investment class and thinking of it as a store of value, I think is interesting enough. I mean, it's already proven that thesis, and I think that's going to stick around for a long time. I think this debate of should it be a medium of exchange or a store of value it's silly. I mean, that's like people still wondering that with gold. It's a $21 trillion bucket that people store value in, whether they store it in art or collectible cars or gold or whatever it is. And I'm just so interested in its investment characteristics, the fact that it still is going to be an uncorrelated source of returns versus anything else.
And it can be for you what you want it to be.
Sure.
So that other thing, what is Bitcoin? It's kind of what do you need it for? These are the things these are its properties. you know, like say a store of value, yeah. or you know, it's unconfiscatable and you know, censorship resistant. You know,
sure, it's a way for people to get property rights if they can't in their country.
Yeah. So for me, it's kind of like my pension got decimated in my divorce. I'm kind of like, this is a potential pension for me. You know, leave it there for 20 years. That might be a pension. But it's also a medium of exchange for me. It's a way for I can get paid by clients easier than going through the banks. I mean, I had the incident when I went out and interviewed Mark Karpeles. I had a cameraman, local cameraman, British guy, but he was based in Japan. He came out and did the work, you know, whatever it was. And I had to pay him a couple of $1,000. I could not connect my bank to his bank. We physically couldn't do it. Yeah, it's an absolute nightmare. And I was like, can I pay you by PayPal? We couldn't get that to work. So I was like, can I pay you Bitcoin? We didn't in the end. But that would have been a solution. If he accepted Bitcoin, I could have just done it. So it can be a medium of exchange. I think the thing is, once you've got Bitcoin, you've held it, you've used it, you find out what it is for you, rather than, say, telling people what they should use it for.
Yeah. Yeah, just the debate on use case, it's so funny to me. Like I said, it's a small group of people on Twitter that are debating it, I think. The inflows that are coming into this space are investing because it's an investable asset that already serves a purpose.
I piss off that small group of people sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I think you do it in a tasteful way now.
Well, so, you know, Luke, the show was always, you know, when I decided it was going, when I did the first couple of trading shows, I thought it was going to be a show about trading. And it came out the same time as Crypto Street Pod. And I was like, they're nailing the trading.
Those guys are great.
Yeah, well, none of them like me, but but they did a good job of the trading stuff, and it was kind of funny at times. And I was like, and then I did the LOP interview and the Lin one. I was like, actually, no, I want to do more of the kind of humor stories. But anything that's education based, all these people are like, oh, he doesn't run a fucking node, or he's stupid, he doesn't understand Bitcoin. I'm glad I don't understand how the protocol really genuinely works, like on a technical level. And as controversial as this is, I don't want to, because the people who need to know how it works, Jameson Lopp knows how it works, Peter Wille knows how it works, all the people that matter, Luke Dasher know how it works, Matt Carello, they know how it works, and I fundamentally trust them. I do not need to be debating about technically what needs to come next for Bitcoin, because I don't care, I sure trust them. But what I do care about is that if I understand too much, I don't want to be so far removed from new people coming in and not understand their experience. I much rather align myself with people who've just discovered Bitcoin and their experience.
Sure, and it makes a better show, and like you said, it's more relatable. I mean, you probably even understand some things about Bitcoin at a more granular level than I do. I was speaking with Matt Odell, and I was asking about convenience and security trade-offs. And I asked some dumbass questions on Twitter where people still comment below. They're like, how do you have this many followers in this? I'm like, that's not why people follow me. It's not for a technical prowess of Bitcoin. I'm very aware about that. I'm not going to ever try to kid anyone. I'm here learning about that stuff as well.
Yeah. So. Matt's awesome. I pick his brain all the time.
Yeah.
But I even got that challenge because I've been like, usability, UX must be better. No one's going to run a fucking node, blah, blah, blah. Like, I got so much shit for that node stuff. Actually, the flip side to that is I got a lot of people write to me also and say, oh, that was really good. That was really useful. I still think very few people are going to run a node.
I saw the replies to your thread, and I couldn't even understand half the words in there. I mean,
they couldn't even agree. Yeah, they were arguing
exactly
amongst themselves.
And it presented the exact reason for you suggesting the question of, what do I choose here? You know, does it need to be easier? All those things. But it gets ignored. I mean, it's great that there are those people that are that dedicated to knowing it, and it's healthy for the space, and people have to continue pushing it forward.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you can't know everything. I mean, it's impossible.
Well, I had my assumptions challenged. I was listening to Janine interviewed by Marty Bent on Tales from the Crypt, and she was saying she preferred it when the UX was terrible because I might get this slightly wrong, so people should listen to the show, but it didn't allow people to have the trade-offs. Like right now, people will use Coinbase because
that's,
it's really easy to use. But by using Coinbase, they're given all their KYC information over. They're given all their information to chain analysis. There's that horrible company. What were they called? The one that Coinbase bought. Fuck, I've forgotten what they're called. Really like nasty company.
Then they had to make a public statement about kind of deleting their contract with them. I forget who it was.
Or they sacked some of the people. But yeah, so, you know, and that made me go, oh, God, you know what? That's a really fair point. But again, I stand by the fact that, look, if Bitcoin is for everyone, we've got to think of it as something that's as easy to use as your debit card. And I think if you want everyone to have perfect privacy, use Tor, to be using a mixer like on something like Samurai, I said it's just not, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Majority of people are going to go on Coinbase or Kraken. They're going to buy their first bit of Bitcoin. They're hopefully going to get a hardware wallet, but might not. You know, we've got to accept this and you know, really think of these people.
Yeah, it can't always be a baby. I mean, there has to be, those trade-offs are going to exist. And if anything, I think it's going to continue to go down that route.
Have you got a node?
No.
Are you going to set up a node?
I was going to. I believe the coin mine I have, it will have that capability pretty soon.
You've got a coin mine?
Yeah.
I've heard that's a scam.
I've heard it as well. But I've heard it as well, and it's running in my basement.
It doesn't actually mine Bitcoin, does it? It mines shitcoins and converts them to Bitcoin.
Correct. It algorithmically selects whatever, what is it, Grin, ETH, Monero, Zcash, and something else. And then whatever other coin he adds. What they recently added was, this is like a coin mine ad now, but I really like Farboud. I think he's a great guy, good buddy. And I just believe in him trying to further the industry. There's been so much talk about, does the device, you know, is it more appropriate to buy Bitcoin? Is it a better $800 investment? Is it going to ROI all these things? But now they have, you know, if you mine Bitcoin or you mine your sats, you can put those sats to work, all these different things. So I know that some Bitcoiners even hate that term anyways, but it does get people interested. That's how I got into the space. I built an ETH rig. And ever since then, understanding how the network works, you start to understand things. Even that device did an ROI, but it was still one of the best learning experiences I think you can have.
I got a lot of flak back with BlockFi.
Yeah.
I really like it. I'm a customer. I actually deposited some Bitcoin on it, and I get interest every month. But I got a lot of flak back from people saying, this is antithetical to Bitcoin, not your, you know, not your keys, not your Bitcoin. You're trusting somebody else. Like, there could be a catastrophic market breakdown where you lose all your Bitcoin, blah, blah, blah. I'm kind of a fan of these services. I mean, there are others. Well, you know, I shouldn't just say BlockFi just because they're a sponsor. There is Unchained Capital. There's a few others doing it.
I think what's appropriate, and I think what there were some issues with, was maybe how it was marketed. But I still didn't even have a problem with that. It was just to make it clear that, yes, this is a risk you're taking. That's why you're getting paid that yield. It's not as straightforward as, you know, you're putting your Bitcoin down, you get an interest payment straight back in Bitcoin. You're literally betting that, you know, BlockFi will pay you back. But at the same time, if people understand that risk, then that's their money or Bitcoin to put at risk.
Yeah.
Right? It's this weird, you know, morality that's like shoved on people. It's like, if you want to take that risk, as long as you aren't, you know, lulling people in with false promises and promoting something or whatever it is, that's your capital to put at risk.
Yeah, it's not a scam. And also, this is a free market, right?
You
Bitcoiners, you want a free market? Well, this is a company these are companies that have emerged from a free market who are offering a service.
Sure.
And I think, like, as Bitcoin grows and as it takes over and hyper-Bitcoinization, if it happens, then there's going to be a market for borrowing and lending Bitcoin. That's going to be huge.
Yeah.
I mean, I think some of these companies, they could be potential unicorns.
Yeah.
As long as Bitcoin grows.
Yeah.
We don't stay in this region forever, this endless bear market of hell.
I wouldn't even say it's a bear. I mean, 2019, we started at 3K.
Yeah, it's right a now, bear market that's people up nearly 300%.
People still think of it as a bear market. It's like, put something in context. This is still the best performing asset in the world for the entire year. I mean, it's the fact that you can earn 300% uncorrelated everything. It's not like we're, you know, betting on Tesla and exposed to the stock market. This is something that moves entirely separate from that.
Have you gone into the whole Austrian economics and libertarian side of things? Because that's something that I've really been sucked into.
Oh gosh, I did listen to your show with Stefan. I have Seyfedin's book. I haven't read it.
It's a good read.
Yeah, I find it all quite interesting. I guess I went to finance school. The funny part is, I almost side with Joe Weisenthal on some of these talks a little bit more, just in the sense that I don't really think central bankers per se are evil, and all this money printing is to, you know, thwart people and cause them to be poor and whatever else it is. I really do think it's just our society and how we formed and trying to grow more business and
careful.
I know. I'm gonna piss some people off just as Joe did. But I don't think it's evil as much as literally trying to find the best solution at the time. And sure, it might have now evolved into something which is more risky and less understood than it should be. But I don't believe that central bankers or bankers in general are evil and it's this master plan and all these things.
Well, maybe they're just trying to fix the stupidity of government. I mean, it's the government overspends, right?
Or we're going down this path. We're going down this path of now we're hooked on QE, as Travis Kling likes to say. I really think it's just, you know, as things are rolling, we try to find the best solution. We patch it up. I just don't think the intent is bad. Maybe the methods in which we're doing this is not so good, but intent is really important. I really do think that this is the system we've created and we're trying to support this economy and we're trying to support as many businesses and people as we can. Whether or not they should play a role, I guess that's the Austrian versus Keynesian debate. But where I come from, I just don't think it's evil intent. I think we've rolled along this far. Our economy is massive. There are tons of people on this planet Earth. And this is the best system we've come up with for now.
Yeah, I tend to, like I said, as I said a moment ago, I tend to think it's more the stupidity of government. And I think there are evil people in government. And I think the problem with government, it's about power. And I also find in the US, this very strange lobbying thing. I find the lobbying side and the fact that you can be paid by lobbyists.
Sure.
Very strange.
It's bizarre.
It's a system of corruption, essentially.
I'm a massive fan of the smaller the government, the better. Right, the less overreach, all those things. But I was specifically talking about the Fed and that.
Yeah, but I think of this, it's the government that make the decisions. It's
sure.
The government that overspends. It's the government that comes up with all the stupid departments to create the stupid rules for all the stupid things we have to do, overspends, and therefore has to turn to the central bank to fix their problems. Am I seeing this wrong? You know this better than me.
The central bank, that monetary policy is completely separate from, you know, Donald Trump can try to influence. I think he's the first president. Well, there was one president way back that was maybe at odds with or tried to influence the central bank, but this is kind of the first time they're doing it on Twitter. I mean, it's like it's this grand theater now. You can see the president literally try to intimidate central bankers into doing what he wants. If anything, it's the biggest ad. I mean, it's the best ad for Bitcoin ever. I think people will realize that even if bankers and the system we're in, it is people trying to do their best to support the economy and to grow things and to make sure the most amount of people do well, that people will make mistakes and people are emotional, yeah. Like our president or a certain central banker or it's a certain nation. You know, in the United States, we're lucky. But other nations around the world are showing that they're maybe not as responsible. So
Donald Trump is so good at Twitter.
Oh, it's incredible.
He
doesn't get enough credit. Even if you don't like the guy, he doesn't get enough credit there.
He's so fucking funny sometimes as well. Like the way he trolls people, he kills me.
The meme warfare is so real.
Yeah.
I mean, he's very good at, he's very good at attention. And it's he's winning that war, whether you like him or not.
Well, whoever wins the nomination for the Democrats, who I've got no idea, by the way, but whoever wins it, and it's going to be a train wreck watching it, but just watching, like they were talking about this on Rogan, like watching how Donald Trump will go after them with his meme war on Twitter is going to be, it's going to be amazing to view, just fucking insane.
Just from an entertainment aspect, yeah.
Yes. I haven't been following the Democratic nomination debates too much.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem like a very strong candidate amongst them.
It doesn't interest me. I just don't have, I spend very little, if none, of my time following any of that stuff. It's all theater.
You're not going to declare your political allegiances on my podcast.
No, I have no interest in doing that.
All right, man. All right, how did the Colts do yesterday?
What's that?
How did the Colts do?
I didn't even watch the game, but I think we're actually pretty good. The backup quarterback. Andrew Luck backs out at the beginning of the season. We're still doing well.
Yeah. You've been very good at dealing with trolls online.
Yeah.
I think I've seen you snap once.
When was that?
That wasn't long after you gave me a telling off. Someone made an accusation against you and you flipped.
I don't
and
recall.
Then you did and you deleted the tweets. I was amazed. It's like with Pomp. I think he's the most trolled person.
Sure.
On Twitter.
Yeah.
He flipped recently on Dudas, but that was again the first time. I lose my shit every time I get trolled. Fuck you, motherfucker. How do you keep so calm?
Oh man, you know, I'm not really sure. I think I realized really quickly that, especially if it's just it's so stupid. The shit that people even talk about on there or make a discussion or make an accusation about. I think the one time I will flip is if it is kind of a pure accusation of something I've done or something like that. I kind of want to correct the timeline, but I realized that if anything, I'm just giving more attention to it. And so the mute button is a blessing. I mean, it's a powerful tool, and I recommend that everyone use it.
I block more than mute. I want them to know.
Yeah, I block some as well, but I think I just spend so much less time on Twitter. At the beginning, it was almost like a game, I guess, kind of like the podcast in a way. I'm sure you look at your download numbers and want to grow them and all these different things, and that's not the only thing going on, but it is an incentive system of you see what your audience likes, you see what you want to learn about and all these different things, and after a while, I don't have any interest in having any more followers, and if anything, it's now just more of a risk or kind of an issue. I can't really talk about all the things I want to, or you know, I throw in a meme or a joke or whatever it is, and you get 30 people commenting asking if am I serious about that. It's like, yeah. No. So
it comes with pressure. Like nothing prepares you for it. I remember we were talking about it last night. I think I had around 5,000 followers when we did this, but it might have been a lot less. I might have had like 1,000 followers. Who knows? But I didn't have a lot, and you were at like 30,000. I seem to remember. You very quickly went over to like 150,
yeah.
160, and I got to about 30. Now I've come up to like nearly 75, and you're like, what, 220 now?
Something around there, yeah.
But it's, I don't think anything prepares you for it because it can get insane. Like you say, you can put something out that's slightly wrong, people misconstrue it.
Yeah, but I also realized, I think one of the things that I was so okay with, especially when I put my face out there, and if you use your real name and your real picture, like, there are times, obviously, I wish I was still anonymous, but if you're using your real name and your real face, there are some things that are so fucking dumb that I don't even want to associate with now, yeah. now that my real name's there. So I think that keeps me out of a lot of trouble and just kind of having integrity in that sense. And then also understanding and acknowledging and accepting that I'm going to be wrong all the time. And I've never really had a problem with that. I don't get on there and pretend to be a guru or you know, be able to predict any of these things. I throw out a ton of ideas. I'm wrong all the time. I don't know a lot of stuff, but I'm just going to kind of continue to learn and share some ideas and all those different things. And so if you go into it with this idea of I have to be perfect or have this persona or always be right or be a perfect trader, you're fucked. So if you, if you accept that you're just, you know, sharing some ideas still, I think you'll do pretty well. I don't know.
Another quite powerful thing that I've done before is to acknowledge mistakes and apologize,
yeah.
Which not many people do. And it's quite liberating, actually. You know, I've put out some really stupid shit sometimes. And I said, you know, or I've put out something and I've realized I've not researched something I should have and the facts are wrong. And when I've been wrong, I've retweeted and said, this was a mistake. I apologize. That's actually, I think a lot more people should do that because you only benefit from it. You don't get people trolling you and giving you shit. Everyone always respects you for it, but people don't seem to do it.
Yeah, you know, for me, sharing investment ideas or just kind of my thoughts on what I'm doing, there's still every once in a while you get it. People retweet or be like, you know, wrecked or you blew it or God, I can't believe it and all these different things. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, on a good week, I'm hoping to be 50-50. Like, so I don't know. It's just this idea that I'm going to be wrong. I've been wrong a million times when there before. And so it takes a lot of the pressure off.
So what are your long-term plans, man? Like, do you think like 5 years ahead, what you'd like to be doing and where you'll be at with all this?
Yeah. I think that's one of the most exciting things about having the show. The one idea that is most similar to what I want to do and what I've always found interesting since being here is the access I get to people that are investing in this and some insanely smart investors spending all their time here now and willing to share it. In the finance world, you could dream about wanting to speak to this portfolio manager, or, you know, whatever it is, hedge fund, you know, CIO, never get that access, ever. But now I have this, for whatever reason, I spent, you know, too much time on Twitter and enough people understood it, that now I have the access to ask them all those things. So Raul of Real Vision, I think he has a pretty similar concept of almost what I want to do. I'm fascinated by wanting to learn what a lot of the top investors here are doing, but also outside of crypto, like also want to learn about what any other investor is doing in any other market or other stories like sports betting, all those different things. So,
yeah, Rao's great.
Yeah, Rao's good.
I did a show with him and it just blew up. The numbers were insane.
It was a good show.
He's a really interesting guy to talk to. I think there's more and more people like Dan Tapiro. There's more and more people like that who are starting to appear that I think are making this, that giving a different conversation and it just makes it a bit more interesting. So
yes, so the show is one angle, and then also, like I said, I'm really interested in, I came from the FX world and worked for one of the largest brokers here in the US. So I'm really interested in seeing how these exchanges will grow and making some investments in there and helping those companies out. And that whole side of the investment side of this industry, it's almost like there's so many Bitcoiners that don't want to focus on that. It's evil. What, you know, why are you worried about price, all those different things? That's what's so fascinating to me is working in the most exciting part of finance, which was fringe finance and is now on the front lines. This is the opportunity of a lifetime. There's not too many times in your life that an asset class gets created, accrues this much value, and has the potential to change so many things. So
it might be the last time in our lifetimes.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. Like, this is, assets don't just up and get created. And if they do, they don't turn into $200 billion or you know, $1 trillion market cap. So
how do we get more people in? How do we get more people interested? Because right now it's, you know, I'm struggling. Like, I'm constantly telling my friends about it, teaching them about it on Facebook. No one gives a fuck.
Yeah, for me, like, it's so reflexive. Like, if you look at when everyone joined in 2017, or when most people joined, the guys that I, you know, kind of came in with or started learning about it with and saw their names pop up and they're still here, it was when price was going through an exponential rise or a parabolic rise. And so if that happens again, I'm sure a new wave of people will come. I'm not so worried about, I guess, getting the retail side in. I think that over time, it's just going to continue to grow like it is. And so that part of it just doesn't concern me so much.
It's there ready for you when you do.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, listen, look, it's always good to talk to you.
Yeah.
Getting to know you over this last 2 years. You know, you're not just somebody's come on the podcast. You've become a friend. We've hung out a bunch of times. I love what you do. I know I can rely on you if I get in touch and I need anything. So I wish you all the best. I wonder if we'll be here in 2 years doing it again. I hope so.
Yeah, you'll be on episode, you know, 400 and have 400. 10 shows by then.
Oh, fuck, man. I don't know if I can do 10 shows. It's struggling enough with two now.
You'll have an empire.
Oh, honestly, dude, trying to keep up with everything is insane. Like, before we came out last night, I was recording an intro to get to my engineer. Then we went out, and then I got up, and it was published. And, you know, and I want to go to a daily show, but if I do that, I've got to become very disciplined about my time. But, no, I hope in 2 years we are doing this again. You know, it's it'd be great if we are.
Yeah, it's a nice way to recap.
I mean, Bitcoin's still a thing as well.
Bitcoin will still be a thing. It'll be bigger than ever.
All right, Luke, tell people where to find you and find your show, man.
Yeah, follow on Twitter, Venture Coinist, and Coinist Podcast as well. I have a new series coming out. We're going to be talking about Bitcoin as a store of value. That word gets thrown around so much, but I don't think anyone really understands.
You've let the cat out of the bag now.
Yeah, well, you know, someone can try to copy. It's already in the works. But it'll be, instead of just digital gold, it'll be Bitcoin as a store of value versus every other store of value, and that's the bucket that I think we're competing in. It's a $21 trillion bucket versus just the $6 trillion gold bucket. So that'll be fun. Follow along, Coinist Podcast.
All right, man. We'll keep crushing it.
Yeah. Cheers.
All right. How good was that? 2 years after my very first podcast, Luke is back on the show. What a crazy 2 years. Like, I could not have predicted all this would happen. The podcast was, you know, it was just a bit of fun. It was just like an idea, and it's become this big ass thing, which I've been so fortunate to travel around the world and record and meet so many amazing people. So honestly, anyone who has supported the show, I freaking love you. Thank you so much. I couldn't have done it without the guests, the sponsors, the listeners, even the trolls have helped. But every one of you, I love you. Thank you so fucking much. It's crazy how much stuff has also changed in that time. You know, even for Bitcoin, it's been this like horrible bear market, but so many interesting things happen as well. Also, Luke is such a great guy. Like, I can genuinely say he's become a good friend. We've hung out a few times over this last couple of years. Consensus in New York. We've hung out in Vegas. He was with me for my 40th birthday. And he's been a huge supporter of the show. And it's really cool to see he's committing more time to his podcast going forward. I hope he smashes it. He's a great guy. He deserves it. If you haven't checked it out, head over to Luke's Coinist podcast. It focuses on markets, exchanges, and trading. He does cover a little bit of shitcoin, sorry, but he's coming around. He's mainly Bitcoin now, so we'll give him a break on that. But definitely worth a listen. So big thanks to Luke. Thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for being a friend. Thanks for everything you've done, mate, to support me. Love you, dude. If you have any feedback on the show, it's hello at whatbitcoindid.com. Look forward to hearing from you. As I mentioned, I'm out in Texas recording a bunch of shows. Tomorrow I'm going to be heading out to LA. And next week, yes, I might change my plans. I really want to go to these fucking crazy Trump rallies. And it turns out there's one in Florida. So I might head down there, check that craziness out. If you're there, if you want to hang out, let me know. Also, I might then head to DC and then probably into New York for Thanksgiving. And then I'll be back home. Also, don't forget to check out my Bitcoin show on Defiance with Andreas, Why We Need Bitcoin. It's a great show. He did a really amazing job. Thank you, Andreas. All right, any questions, feel free to hit me up. It's hello at whatbitcoindid.com.